In this part of Focus 580, we will consider this question. Is profiling ever appropriate? The answer that our guest this morning offers is, in some cases, yes. He argues there is such a thing as good profiling and bad profiling. His name is Frederick Schauer. He is Frank Stanton Professor of the First Amendment at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and has authored a book exploring this subject. It's titled Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes. It's published by Belknap Press, which is a division of the Harvard University Press. It's available now in bookstores. And questions and comments are welcome here on this program if you want to be involved in the conversation. The number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Schauer, hello.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I'm delighted.
I understand that from what I have read is that part of the I'm sure these are issues that you have thought about before, but part of the what got you going on this and led to this book project has to do with pit bulls.
Yes, I mean, in a semi-serious way, I've been interested in rules for a long time and generalizations for a long time, but a number of years ago and up to the present, a number of different communities trying to deal with the problem of aggressive, dangerous dogs and recognizing that a few breeds, especially pit bulls, were more likely than most others to be dangerously aggressive, either banned pit bulls or imposed special restrictions on pit bulls. Hmm. The pit bull people went berserk. There were cries of canine racism, breedism, control deeds and not breeds, and all of this struck me as so frankly silly that I started thinking more seriously about the ways in which the language and concepts of anti-discrimination, the language and concepts of racism were being used all over the place, and the way in which there seemed to be some notion out there, one that struck me as wrong, that generalizations were always inappropriate, stereotypes were always inappropriate, profiles were always inappropriate. Hmm. This book came out of that kind of thinking.
Well, we can talk a little bit more about that. In law school, we like case studies, so we can talk about this idea a little bit more. Obviously, people will know that there has been, in recent years, or maybe more than years, concern about incidents involving vicious dogs, and apparently a number of these were pit bulls. And so people say, as you said, in various places, they said, well, this is a real problem, and so we're going to say people just can't have these kinds of dogs. And then, of course, people who are interested in dogs and know about dog behavior, these breeds and others, will come out and say, well, look, really, there's no such thing as a bad dog. What we're talking about here is irresponsible owners, people who have raised dogs to be vicious and allow them to be vicious, and that it doesn't make any sense to say the problem is the breed, because this it could be any dog that we're talking about here, and that gets us into the problem. Some people would say the problem with the formulation of all X is Y, all something is something, all pit bulls are dangerous. So that means if we want to deal with the problem of dangerous dogs, get rid of the pit bulls, and you've solved the problem. That's what makes you makes the leap to talking about. Talking about from dogs to talking about other things. But I guess it seems the problem is that it seems that that both sides in this particular case make a reasonable argument, and one that does indeed make sense. How though do you think about trying to sort out the two sides and which argument in fact is the more persuasive, particularly I guess if you're talking about not just an abstract issue, but you're talking about public safety?
Right. I think we have to start from the view that there are some profiles, some stereotypes that are quite simply, as the statisticians would call it, spurious. In the 19th century, people believed in phrenology. You could determine somebody's personality by the bumps on their head. It turns out that bumps on heads were totally spurious. we can put those aside, or at least the first part of the analysis is recognizing that some things are simply superstitions like that. And some of these superstitions are far more pernicious today. The view that gay men lack courage, for example, again, has absolutely no statistical basis. Then, however, there are ones in which, of course, it's not universal. There are many, many friendly and docile pit bulls, but still there is a probabilistic or statistical soundness to the view that certain X's are more likely to be Y than other things. Even controlling for training methods, pit bulls and a few other breeds are more likely to be aggressive than others, in just the same way that people under the age of 17 or 18 or 21 are more likely to be irresponsible drinkers than others, which is why we set the minimum drinking age at 21. People who are 12 are more likely to be irresponsible drivers than those who are 17, so we set driving ages, depending on the state, at 15 or 16 or 17. All of these are far from universal, but they're probabilistic. Then we have to think about which of the probabilistic ones are we willing to use. I'm comfortable with pit bulls. I'm comfortable, although slightly less so, with mandatory retirement for commercial airline pilots at the age of 60, which is current policy. I'm quite comfortable with minimum ages for drinking and driving and voting. In some circumstances, there is such a tendency of people to overuse even statistically reliable indicators that it may be necessary to mandate their underuse, to prohibit their use, just to prevent their overuse. And then we get much closer to current issues about racial profiling, profiling at airports and so on.
Mm-hmm. But if, in your mind, where is the term stereotype necessarily negative?
Or would you say no? As a matter of English usage, it has become negative. It's become pejorative, but we stereotype all the time. I mean, I use the age examples. I use the dog examples, and there are lots of others, even more benign. We think that some brands of cars are more likely to be reliable than others. People don't talk about brandism. People don't talk about the morality of stereotyping Fords or Toyotas or Subarus or Volvos, but we're engaged in the same kind of process. From some characteristic that's probabilistically but not universally more likely located within certain classes than others, we generalize. So do those are all stereotypes, and the method of thinking is the same.
Well, just to use the phrase that you use in the book, all of us all the time, we paint with the broad brush.
Right.
We use generalizations. We do that to get through the day.
Right.
We sort of have to do that. But I guess the big issue is here is what happens when this kind of thinking becomes public policy. And how is it that we deal with this, particularly when we're talking about criminal justice issues? How does one draw that line? And can you purely do this on, again, you talk in the book about how the way to know when it's okay and when it's not is if we are thinking in terms of hard numbers of data, that we're approaching this in an actuarial sense.
Right.
It's the same way the insurance company does when they sit down and they think, well, how much are we going to charge people who are in their 20s, and how much we can charge people in their 30s, and how much are we going to charge people in their 60s? And one of the things we're going to do is look at the statistics that say, well, how well do these people drive, and how frequently are they going to be in accidents? And based upon that, we're going to decide decide what sort of rates we're going to charge. You're making the argument that the law can approach the issue in that same, with that same mindset?
It can. Often does and often should, but that's not to say that it always should. There are two related problems. One is the problem, especially in the context of race, gender, and a couple of other categories, of reinforcing existing forms of oppression, exclusion, and the like. And there is the related problem that certain factors, for historical reasons, are likely to crowd out others and therefore be used inappropriately, such that we have to prohibit their use even when they're a little bit relevant. There were some incidents shortly after September 11th in which airline personnel, pilots, flight attendants, and the like, identified young Middle Eastern origin men on an airplane by name or by visual inspection, and immediately refused to fly if they were going to be on the plane. The problem is that they were able, by name or appearance, to identify the fact that these were men, identify the fact that they were of Middle Eastern origin. These people had no way of knowing whether the person who was sitting next to the young Middle Eastern man might just have been released from prison after three explosives violations, and was a member of the same militia group as Timothy McVeigh. Something about the visibility of race, of gender, and a few others, as well as past history and in-group, out-group social psychology, leads people to focus on one out of potentially 45 or 50 or however many relevant factors, and by focusing on the one, they exclude all of the other relevant factors. This tendency of race, especially, to crowd out so many other things often makes it necessary to exclude race even when it, along with a whole bunch of other factors, might be relevant. Mm.
Well, this I'm sure this is sort of a simple-minded layperson's question, but if you look at the case there that you're talking about, and we do have to allow the fact that before September 11th, the most serious terrorist action carried out in this country was not carried out by a Middle Eastern man or a Muslim man. It was indeed the Oklahoma City bombing. It was Tim McVeigh. But if you do look at the numbers, though, and you look at some September 11th and other recent terrorism, and you'd ask the question, well, who is it that, as far as we know, was responsible for this? They were indeed young Middle Eastern Muslim men. And so one can imagine somebody in, say, in law enforcement saying, well, if you're saying to me that you want me to be on the lookout for people who are potentially dangerous, and I can't check everybody, so what I'm going to do is look at the salient characteristics of the people who've committed these crimes in the past, which is what profiling is, and we're going to say, okay, this is the person that I think is likely to be a suspect, so we're going to keep our eye on people like that. I mean, if you say to me, we really don't want you to paying so much attention to young Muslim men from the Middle East, then I guess I can imagine people in law enforcement saying, well, okay, what am I supposed to pay attention to? I
mean, right. And the problem is that, as you say, on all of the evidence we have, this is relevant. But so too is whether someone pays for a ticket in cash. So too is whether they're a member of a frequent flyer program. So too is whether they're flying one way rather than round trip. So too is whether they're flying with only carry-on luggage. So too is where they're coming from and where they're going to. There are a whole bunch of factors like this. If because of past prejudice or laziness or whatever, law enforcement officers or the rest of us are focusing on just race and ignoring the other, let us say, 40 equally relevant factors, it turns out that they're doing a bad profiling job and race is crowding out all of the other relevant factors. This is a real problem, and it's one of the reasons why it may be important, even in the service of law enforcement efficiency, to preclude use of one or several admittedly relevant factors.
So what we've got to do is overcome our natural tendencies to want to strip things down to the simplest possible set of characteristics.
Or the one that's most visible, even if the one that's most visible is not the one that's most predictive.
So not the simplest, not the most salient, but to look at this as a much more complex kind of...
Right, and that's why... This issue has occasionally been before the U.S. Supreme Court. There are a couple of different Supreme Court cases that have indicated that use of race as part of a multi-factor profile is permissible, although use of race alone is not.
Now, one of the things that law enforcement around the country, at least in some places, and now I believe that we've just been required here in the state of Illinois, law enforcement is now required to keep statistics on who it is they stop and some of the characteristics of these people to try to answer this question. Well, are you doing the kind of profiling that we don't want you to do? Do you think that's a useful exercise?
It's useful, especially. I think it is useful, and it's useful especially in light of a history of, it's best not even to call it profiling, but simple harassment. That is, targeting people because of their race, even though there's no indication that race is relevant. Closer to you than to me, there were these incidents at O'Hare Airport in the late 80s through mid 90s of African American women being disproportionately stopped on the suspicion that they were drug couriers, and then being subject to quite intrusive, humiliating body cavity searches and the like. It turns out that there was no indication whatsoever that either race or gender was even probabilistically indicative of who was likely to be a drug courier. So it's best not even to think of this as profiling, but rather just as straight harassment. These kinds of incidents are common enough that requiring some degree of monitoring, requiring records in order to be able to track this, strikes me as a wise policy in light of what the history has been.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Frederick Schauer. He is Frank Stanton Professor of the First Amendment at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and has authored a book exploring this subject, Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. You should be able to find it in the bookstore if you're interested in reading it. And, of course, questions, comments are welcome here on the show in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Do you have a caller here to start us off in Lovington? And the caller is on line one. Hello.
I may have a question. I may just be repeating what you're saying. It seems to me like, at least in my personal experience as a human being, that I just have a horrible time looking at people according to their appearance and making much of a judgment at all about them. You know, somebody looks, I guess, must look like the guy that stole my lunch in second grade, and I don't like him right off the bat. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it just seems like, and I also know that people, most people, and I think even professional people out of their own jobs, have a horrible time understanding and using statistics.
Right.
And that may be one of the problems with this.
Right. I mean, you correctly say that part of the problem is not just about race as such, but that appearance is likely to be one of those factors that people overuse, and therefore it's good to guard against it. It used to be thought, indeed some people still think it, that people with close-set eyes are sneaky and are not to be trusted. But the fact that appearance is frequently unreliable is, of course, not to say that everything is unreliable. What we know about background, education, past practices, and everything else may be much more reliable but much less visible. So the question, therefore, or the issue, therefore, is not to say we should never never profile, we should never stereotype, we should never generalize, because that's impossible. But to guard against the way in which physical appearance seems to loom so much larger for people than its empirical contribution would actually justify.
Would you, other than appearance, would you agree or disagree that it's extremely hard, it's pretty hard for most people in general just to even figure, even to take statistical evidence and...
Yes, it is certainly hard for people to do that, but it is also unavoidable that they will do that. If you tell them that they should look at everyone as an individual, what they are still doing is relying on this individual has close set eyes, or this individual looks funny to me, or this individual has a little tick over his or her eye, or is fidgeting his fingers, or something of that sort. Even things that look totally individual are based on often hidden and frequently erroneous statistics. So I would rather see the statistics out in the open, available for inspection in the broadest sense, than rely on the statistics that exist between people's ears, but they're relying on statistics all the time.
Right, I understand. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All of your questions and comments are certainly welcome. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. If you'd like to call in, be a part of our conversation, again, with our guest, Frederick Schauer from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. We talked about how in our daily life, we make generalizations all of the time, and in a way, we have to get along.
Right.
How does one make the leap from that to prejudice? Because here, where some of the kinds of terms that we have used are people use in a kind of interchangeable way, although there's an increasing scale of negativity as
right.
you go as you go through some of these kinds of terms. Well, when we go from generalization to stereotype to profiling to prejudice, things get progressively worse and worse.
Yes, and again, I think it's the same issue that if we were to go back 50 years and think just about what it is to prejudge and therefore to have a prejudice, we might not want to say that all prejudices are bad. I am prejudiced against axe murderers and child molesters. Nevertheless, I think we now understand the term prejudice largely to refer to a judgment that itself has no empirical basis. Like, as I said before, gay men lack physical courage, or people with bumps in certain places in their heads have nice dispositions, and so on. I think these days, in common parlance, a prejudice is more likely to be something that is totally spurious.
Mm. Is it always, I guess I think about the fact that, you know, perhaps on certain issues over time, people would have made cogent arguments and maybe even be able to back them up with some kind of data, and that then later we might look back and say, well, that was just wrong. Is it always possible for statistics really to transcend a prejudice?
No, I mean, the statistics can be wrong, scientists can be wrong, the people who do the statistics can have agendas. There are all sorts of ways in which even an allegedly careful process of trying to construct a serious profile can go off the rails. But the only alternative to that is intuitive, unmonitored discretion. And part of what drives me in thinking about all of this is, I suppose, that I worry more about totally unbridled discretion than I worry about the ways in which statistics can be misused, although that is, of course, a problem. But if you ask me whether I worry more about the misuse of publicly available, including the methodology statistics, or about unconstrained, uncontrolled discretion, as when we say to officials or individuals, do what you think best and stop the people that just don't look right to you. I'm more worried about the unbridled discretion than about mistaken statistical evaluations.
All right. We'll talk again with another caller here. The next person is in Urbana, and that would be line one. Hello.
Hello. I would like to add to your definition of stereotype that, hello?
Yes, here.
Oh, okay, from there. That a stereotype is permanent. And, that, I mean, that's why it comes from the word from typing, from typesetting, that means a solid type. And the characteristic of a stereotype is beyond that it's a generalization. It is a generalization that resists change, even though there is information that is contrary. The stereotype persists, and that's what makes it a stereotype. That's why Thurgood Marshall said you shouldn't promote a stereotype even if it is true, because the stereotype persists on its own.
I mean, it's certainly, many of them certainly persist on their own. I like what you've said about the difference between ones that persist and ones that don't. Nevertheless, I think now if there is a dispute at all, it's a dispute only about terminology, because still, when we say that, or when we insist that only people with medical degrees and licenses can practice surgery, only people with law degrees can practice law, only people with certain grades and scores can get into selective universities, all of this, we're again relying on past evidence and projecting it into the future. I think part of my point is that we cannot avoid doing that, even under circumstances in which we know what we know from the past is useful in terms of the future. In that sense, it is, as you properly say, at least partially permanent, but I'm not sure how we could even think or act if we didn't make future decisions based on past practice.
All right, let's go to Chicago for another caller here on our toll-free line. Hello.
I was wondering if your study, if you looked at the medical field, because I've found in public health, that's one area where racial profiling is almost pernicious in its effect, because many times studies are done, and while the attending person, the researcher, is very careful about how he set up his statistical plans, there's always an area in every study that's called discussion. And in discussion, you don't have to have any type of background. Sometimes people don't even cite their sources, and they discuss why they got the results. And what I've found over the years is that quite often what they simply fall back on are racial stereotypes, and they will attribute things to race, which is more and more has very little biological integrity, and instead of looking at socioeconomic status, and they'll make comments or say something that later on is what's publicized, because most people don't understand the rest of the study, but everybody can understand the discussion. So when the study is reported, they're using this discussion, which is probably the least scientifically based part of the entire research. And what I've seen again and again is that medical professionals are relying on that. We rely on that to make public policy. And I hope that you looked at that, or you will be.
Yes, I mean, I have looked a little bit at that, and as you probably know better than I do, there is an active controversy within medicine right now about the extent to which racial or ethnic factors ought to be used. Certainly consistent with what I was saying a few minutes ago about crowding out. As you say, it's possible that some of these factors are going to crowd out everything else. On the other hand, even controlling for socioeconomic status and others, there's reasonably good evidence that certain forms of race and ethnicity may be actually relevant to a medical diagnosis. It turns out that certain forms genetic mutations likely to produce a somewhat higher incidence or risk of breast cancer are slightly more located in women of Eastern European Jewish origin than are located in other people. African American men may have a higher risk of hypertension and all of the heart problems that come with that. It would be a grave problem, as you said, to take this as the only or most important factor, but I would guess that a good, careful medical diagnostician is going to at least put this into 30 or 40 or 82 other factors in trying to come up with a diagnosis and a treatment.
And that's the problem. You said a good, careful. A lot of doctors only have 15 minutes with a patient, and so they don't go that far. They fall back on the stereotypes.
Right. They fall back on one factor rather than a whole bunch of others, just in the way that the airline personnel could see race but couldn't see probably better indicators of likely terrorist tendencies. That may be why it's important in some contexts, as I was saying, to prohibit the use of race even when it is relevant. But we have to start the discussion by recognizing that in some circumstances it may be statistically relevant, which is not to say that it should always be used, but we ought not to pretend that it's never relevant to anything.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions again? Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I think one of the things that I think about in this discussion is that for probably a long time, longer than maybe we have been aware of, there has been an awful lot of institutionalized profiling going on in the world, not just in law enforcement, but in a lot of other places. And it's something that we just didn't really pay very much attention to. And it seems like maybe now we are paying attention to it.
Yes, we're certainly, I mean, it has, as you said, it's existed in law enforcement. Indeed, as you may remember, there used to be a TV show, it's still in reruns, called Profiler. Profiling, in the broadest non-pejorative sense, is a common and necessary law enforcement practice in order to focus on a smaller range of possible suspects, usually having nothing whatsoever to do with race. And whether it be university admissions or professional certification or insurance or everything else, we do this all the time. It's everywhere. And we need to at least recognize that eliminating it totally is neither desirable nor plausible. I would suspect that my car insurance rates are far higher than yours. Assuming that I am as good a driver as you are, that has nothing to do with driving ability. It has to do a lot with the fact that I live in the Boston metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts drivers in general, Boston drivers in particular, are statistically more likely to get into accidents than drivers from central and southern Illinois. So my insurance rates are higher just because of where I live. They would go up if I bought a sports car, not because it would make me a more dangerous driver, but because it would put me in the category of people who own sports cars. Again, the insurance industry could not operate without this kind of generalizing, stereotyping, profiling. We may, for good public policy reasons at times, want to say to insurance companies, you can't use this even if it's relevant. But it's not plausible to imagine that the very institution of insurance could exist without some degree of stereotyping and profiling.
All right, let's go on. We have a caller in Rantoul. That's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I find this very interesting. I think whenever we start talking about identifying potential threats, we have to look at what are the viable threats and what groups or organizations actually pose a threat to either local, national, or international security. While, you know, obviously today the major focus is on Al-Qaeda and the PLO, when we look at the actual number of incidents that have occurred in the United States, the overwhelming majority of those incidents involving explosives, chemical, biological, or any type of other incident have been involved in domestic groups. we've probably got 12 to 13 primary domestic groups that are continuing to pose a threat to the U.S. in, you know, our interests in addition to the international. So I guess what comes down to it is the whole concept of profiling on an individual. It just doesn't make any sense, as I think, as what the author is suggesting, when we should be looking at how do we get viable information of what real threats are.
Right, but that,
and then deal with those issues directly.
Right, but dealing with it directly is still going to involve forms of generalization and therefore forms of profiling or stereotyping, if you will.
Absolutely.
It may turn out that there are far better indicators than race, or that there are a lot of other indicators that ought to be used along with race, which would include a whole lot of things about past practices, group membership, and so on. One of the things in the context of explosive-related terrorism and the kinds of groups you're talking about is there's also the constraint, at least in the United States, of First Amendment freedom of association kinds of issues, such that even if group membership is relevant, as often it may be, we might say that membership in a certain kind of militia group, again, is probabilistically indicative, or at least it tells us something, but it may be that we live in a society that quite properly says the groups that you belong to ought not to be used for law enforcement purposes, even if it turns out that group membership is relevant. So much like race, it may be that group membership, books you take out of a library and a whole bunch of other things, they are relevant, but there are other reasons to say that they should be excluded from consideration despite their relevance. And if there's any theme in all of this, for me, it's the importance of distinguishing between the things we exclude because they are irrelevant and the things we may exclude for other reasons despite the fact that they are relevant.
I totally agree with you. I think we're on a slippery slope, and we're sliding down in an abyss where, I mean, your points are, I think, I'm in total agreement.
Yeah.
And I just wish somehow that we could turn this around.
Yeah. Oh, but of course, I mean, slippery slopes go in both directions. There could be slippery slopes in the opposite direction in which we get so afraid of this form of profiling or that form of stereotyping that we say to police officers, insurance companies, customs officials, and everyone else, don't use any past statistics, don't use any generalizations, just use your own best judgment, which may often, and we've seen this in the past, be even more dangerous.
Absolutely correct. Anyhow, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, thank you for the call. Let's go to Urbana for someone else here. Line two. Hello.
Yeah, you're a First Amendment professor. And
that's my title, yes. That's the other part of my life, as I think and write about free speech, free press issues.
Uh-huh. But the issue you're talking about right now, at least, is to my knowledge, has been, and I'm going by a article in by the FBI here, called "The Role of Race in Law Enforcement: Racial Profiling or Legitimate Use." The key amendments are 4th and 14th.
Yes,
and in particular the 14th.
Right.
Where the issue of statistics becomes very important, but your whole argument so far, at least, I've found somewhat confused and somewhat dangerous in a way. You mentioned that cars are built differently, but we don't talk about brandism.
Right.
But the major argument against racism is that people are not built differently, you know, whereas cars are.
Right, but again, we have to recognize, I think, that There are certain personal characteristics. Age is one that I tend to focus on because people resist the empirical basis for that somewhat less than they resist others. There are personal characteristics, physical characteristics, of which age is a common one, that are statistically relevant. As you correctly say, the 14th Amendment and other parts of the Constitution often prevent us quite properly from using things that may be relevant. But we need to distinguish, in order to think clearly about the issue, between the ones that are relevant and the ones that are not. If we think that the 14th Amendment excludes consideration only of race when it is irrelevant, then the FBI, law enforcement, or others are going to come forward and say, we understand that, but here are the statistics that show that with respect to this or that, it is relevant, so therefore we have to be allowed to use it. In my view, recognizing that in some areas of which race is the most obvious and most important, that it's excluded despite its statistical relevance at times, is a much stronger argument against its use, because if we say that it's excluded only because it's irrelevant, then when the FBI or others say in this context it actually turns out to have some statistical basis, there's no argument against them.
Well, what I hear you talking about is the difference between stating that the suspect was wearing a red shirt versus the proposition that people who wear red shirts commit crimes. You know, it's kind of that kind of difference. But I wanted to ask you about whether or not since you seem to think that statistics are and the FBI kind of agrees on this, but they're coming from it from the other point of view, that if statistics show that that the law enforcement is picking on one group when it should really have been more evenly distributed amongst the different classes, whatever the situation is, you know, that's going to be a fatal flaw in their,
Yes, and that's why, as I was saying before, it may be necessary that we keep records on this just to identify the incidents, like at O'Hare some years ago, when there's a disproportionate focus on people of a certain race or a certain gender or both, even though there's absolutely no profile or absolutely no evidence to indicate that it's relevant at all.
Yeah, but if the statistics show, for example, that blacks are more prone to a particular crime, for example, apparently you seem to think that would justify.
I think I said just the opposite. I said that in many instances it may be important to prohibit its use despite its relevance. But in the particular example you give, I would prohibit the use of race to focus on classes of suspects, but I believe it's important to recognize that we are doing that despite the occasional relevance and not because it's irrelevant. If we say it's because it's irrelevant, we are open to anybody who comes forward and says, yes, but in this case we have the data to show that it's relevant.
Well, let me just ask quickly, and I'll hang up to see if you can manage anything with this. And that is that if you turn it around and say that race is relevant, and that if you end up with statistics that, for example, justify your being showing preferential treatment for statistically, empirically, based discrimination in favor of a certain group, what is left as far as an argument for diversity?
Right. I mean,
I'm hang up and listen. Thanks.
I am I am quite comfortable with, as you correctly say, and I, whether you're comfortable or not, I don't know. I am quite comfortable with group-based affirmative action programs, group-based efforts at diversity, but it turns out that what we are doing, as you correctly point out, is another form of stereotyping or profiling. That is, we are attributing certain characteristics to people because of group membership. When we do that in order to serve goals of affirmative action, compensating for past racism, diversity, and the like, I'm comfortable with it, which is one of the reasons why I think it important not to condemn all forms of profiling, stereotyping, or generalizing, but recognizing that these are things we do all the time, and we then have to engage in a further inquiry about which ones we want to do and which ones we don't.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Frederick Schauer. If somebody wants to call in real quick, we can try to get somebody in. You know, I think that there are probably a lot of people who would say, as an ideal, they would like to try to treat every individual as a unique person and every situation as somehow being unique. And they would resonate with the quote that you have here early in the book from Blake, which I like very much. William Blake, who apparently said, to generalize is to be an idiot. Well, I think we all recognize that, in fact, it is our tendency to generalize, and to particularize it takes deliberate effort. It's not always very easy. I guess I'm interested in your thoughts about this idea about whether, in fact, striving, it is somehow our moral duty in life to strive against generalizing.
Right. And I guess I would say no for two reasons. One, a lot of what people think their moral duty is often turns out in a real world rather than an ideal world, a second best or third best world, to produce less good results than if they don't strive to be perfect. The best is often the enemy of the good. But in addition, there are often circumstances in which to be a member of a group, a team, a community requires some degree of ignoring individual characteristics. To be a member of a community, to be to be an American, to be a member of this team or this club or whatever, often means that certain individual characteristics are less important than the collective. We don't always want to do that. I don't want to make too strong an argument for collective or community values, but they have some place. And even in addition to the mistakes that might be made by people striving to treat everyone as an individual, often it's a good idea not to make it too easy for people to be able to say, in effect, look at me, I'm special, I'm different, I want to be treated differently from everyone else. Sometimes the goals of equality are not the goals of treating everyone as a unique individual, but treating everyone the same despite some number of differences. This is not the only goal, it's not the only important goal, but it has a place in our thinking.
And just to finish up, and forgiving the cliche, but what we're talking about here is something of a balancing act. It's something of walking the line between appropriate generalization and prejudice, at least in an institutional sense, when we talk particularly about the law. How well do you think we're doing now?
I think we are doing a little bit better than we were in the past. That is, I think we have a little bit better an ability than we had in the past to acknowledge and recognize the occasional virtues of stereotyping, profiling, and generalizing. I do worry that at times we go too far in the other direction when we say that because race at times may be relevant along with 48 other factors, that we quickly ignore the other 48. We've got a long way to go. I mean, that's part of why I wrote the book. But I'm more concerned that people think clearly about the issue and not substitute just profile or stereotype or whatever for analysis.
Well, there we will have to stop. And I want to thank you, Professor Schauer, very much for giving us some of your
time.
Thank
you. I've enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.
Our guest, Frederick Schauer, is the Frank Stanton Professor of the First Amendment at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press and certainly should be out there available in bookstores now if you'd like to read it.